everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2021, and you're listening to Episode 230, which is a conversation about the ethics of Christians taking the COVID-19 vaccine. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, an organization committed to equipping Christians and people who hold pro-life views to graciously defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life in a positive and gospel-focused manner. Jay has written an online exclusive viewpoint article for the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called, "Is It Ethical for Pro-Life Christians to Receive COVID-19 Vaccines?" And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Jay, it's good to have you on.
It is great to be back, as always.
Well, as I mentioned, Jay has written this article for us on COVID, and specifically the COVID vaccine, because that's a real big question for a lot of Christians. You know, should they be getting the COVID vaccine, and how do they think through that specifically because of the things that we'll be discussing in this episode? And so, but first of all, when we're talking about vaccines, I want to ask you to kind of give an overview of the scope of this article. So what kind of questions does your article discuss and engage with, and what kind of subject matter and questions are not in the scope of what you cover in this article?
Yeah, when we first talked about working on this article, it was interesting because I was already in the process of studying these things because I have a type 1 diabetic daughter. My wife is a stroke survivor with hypertension. And so I have people in my house who are at higher risk for a symptom. And I'm at 50 now. At 50 years old, I've kind of somehow magically went from 49 to 50. I moved into a realm of higher risk as well for extreme symptoms to COVID-19. And so when I was putting together this article and doing the research, I very deliberately did not engage a couple of different ideas. I wanted to engage questions that I was getting. Number one, is it safe? Because you see this question a lot, or you see this complaint a lot. It happened so fast. It was developed with such urgency. It happened so quickly. There's no way we know if it actually works. We don't understand what it does to our body. Is it safe? And those are the kind of questions that I'm getting at Merely Human Ministries. Is it okay for me to take this? Not just from the moral position, which we'll get to next, but is it safe? And then the other thing was, given the information that people are getting that's been widely disseminated, that there was experiment or within the process of creating these vaccines, as the commonly understood aborted fetal cells were used as part of the experiment or testing process. And so there's some sense of moral guilt and moral cooperation with evil that goes along with taking the vaccines. The other question that I get is, are there fetal cells in the vaccines or used in this process? Were they products of abortion? And is it moral or is it ethical to take these vaccines? What I did not discuss and what is not covered in the scope of this would be just people who have an in-principle objection to vaccinations altogether. I know that there and have friends, people that I respect, who believe that vaccines are in and of themselves unhealthy in some way or another, or that they contribute to a weakening of your overall immune system. They have a lot of different reasons. And so this doesn't cover those people because those people aren't going to object to taking the COVID-19 vaccines based on the idea of these cell lines that were used. These are what we call immortalized cell lines that were used in production in some way or another. They're going to object to it for a whole other host of reasons as a greater category of their rejection of all vaccines. And then the other thing I'm not covering, or that the scope of this doesn't discuss, is that the people who don't believe that COVID-19 represents a unique risk in comparison to other things like the flu, or they just see this as one of the illnesses that we get. They see the number of extreme symptoms or that as being exaggerated or as not as being on outliers to what normally happens where people get sick and get well. And for those people, again, they're going to reject the vaccine, not because they have some in principle objection to the way that it was produced or because they fear it's unsafe, but because they just don't see it as necessary at all. And since their objections would not fall into the areas that I personally wrestled with or that with the questions that I get at Merely Human Ministries, they fall out of the scope of this discussion. Not that they're not worthy of consideration or talking under another set, but at this particular point, they're not of interest to me in this discussion.
So mainly the reason why we asked you to write this article is the big question that most Christians who are pro-life are wrestling with when they think about the COVID vaccine in particular and have been following the news about it. And that is, they are feeling like they need to object to taking this vaccine because it was, you know, like you mentioned, developed quickly and therefore might be unsafe. Because usually when we talk about the development of any kind of major medications or immunizations, it takes many years, you know, approval processes and all kinds of things. And you just think about how long the scientists take with that. So they're wondering, how can this, it seems like a rushed process. So that's one part of it. And the other part of it that we'll talk about is like, how were they developed? What kinds of things were used, particularly fetal cells? But is the accelerated timeline an indication that, you know, these vaccines have not gone through the proper vetting, the proper, you know, testing where they have, you know, trials, clinical trials? So is it, have they been skipping clinical trials? Can you speak to that big question that people have?
All right. So the first question, the question of safety, has to be answered before we move on to the question of the moral nature of it. Because if it's not safe, that's the reason that you don't take it. It's not because you have moral issues the way it was produced. You don't take it because you don't think it'll be healthy for you to take it. So the thing that we have to determine then is it a problem that it was produced so fast? Is it reasonable to believe that they could have produced effective vaccines in so short a window? And I always want to be intellectually curious about this. I don't immediately see the problem. I've seen people who are expressing their disbelief in the ability to turn it around, but they don't seem to have asked the question why or how was this turned around faster than problems before. And so there's a lot of different things you can read, but I do think there's a great video that I mentioned in the article by Dr. Seema Yasmin, and what she talks about. It's a video produced by the Stanford Center for Health and Education. I like it because she gives it in seven concise points. And she breaks it down for us, saying that first, the research on the SARS outbreak in 2002 prepared us to act quickly because there are shared characteristics between SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2, which is COVID-19. They're 80 to 90% the same. And so because of the similarities, there's already been a lot of groundwork done on the research end. As far as the reason that things take a long time is because clinical trials run sequentially. You do one trial, then you do the second trial, then you do the third trial. But because we saw that this was something that had to be done immediately, we took all of the resources, which were by far more than anybody's worked with before on this type of thing, and we were able to run all of those trials simultaneously. You run trial one and two and three all at the same time. And so you don't have that graduation to the next taking more and more time. The medical scientists worked in cooperation in the world. I remember hearing this from a doctor. He said, there's been more written and shared and published about COVID-19 there has been any illness before, and shared in real time all around the world. So there was a cooperation going on within the medical science community that's just never seen before, a shared effort to reach a common goal as opposed to competition to get there first. Unprecedented financial resources were given to this research. Most research has to be done through a process of grant application, grant approval, then the finances are received, and then there's people watching over your shoulder and make sure you're doing what you said you were going to do with that money. That wasn't happening here. Money was being diverted as it was needed to these research opportunities. And so you didn't have that lag time of people looking for resources and money to be able to do the research. It was given to them. The manufacturing of the vaccines actually began prior to the approval. So in most cases, you would wait until the FDA and other governing bodies in other countries had approved the vaccine for use before you would start manufacturing the vaccine. But because we understood that, one, we had high expectation of these things reaching approval because we'd been working on them for a long time. We go back sometimes, you know, more than a couple of decades on the SARS research, a decade or so on the mRNA research, all these coronavirus research. It was already there laying and waiting. And so as we know it's going to get to the FDA approval, we start manufacturing that because it's going to be needed immediately. You're not waiting to get approval, then manufacture. The second you get approval, you're releasing. So that's another reason things happen very fast. Now there's risk there. There's obvious risk because if it didn't get approval. And all of the FDA approval worked as it always does. They were monitoring every one of those clinical trials that are running simultaneously. And if there was a problem in any of them, they would have stepped in and stopped it. mRNA vaccines take less time and less money to develop than traditional live attenuated or viral vector vaccines. They just work differently. And so you don't need the same to produce the same amount of organic material that you would need if you were using the virus in the vaccine. You're using a different way of producing the vaccine. And so this happened, that leads to the speeding it up. And then we had a strategy that had been in place for a long time, as far back as almost, I think like 25 years ago, I was reading books about the next coming epidemic and reading books where people that worked for the CDC and different other organizations were discussing the strategies that they had planned that were begun back in 1918 with evaluating what happened with that particular viral infection that spread across the flu, the Spanish influenza. And so there's been long-standing strategy that was put into place and was ready to go. And so all of this, when you put all these, and I would say, you've got to think about how much money, how much shared and cooperation effort there was, how many research subjects were available. When you get to the trials place, you usually have to look for people to put into trial. In this particular place, you had tens of 30,000 people immediately wanted to go into trial so that they could be test cases for this. This was tested by far more than anything that came before because you had so many people willing to be test subjects within the trials. So the accelerated effort, what they called Operation Warp Speed, there's reasonable explanations for how they were able to get there fast. If there were unreasonable explanations, if there was some point that you look at this and say, there was the place that a mistake was made, then I could see somebody having the objection saying, well, I don't trust that it's safe. But every medical expert that I read or reached out to talk about this had the exact same response. They said everything that has ever been done to make sure that vaccines were safe were done during this clinical trial. So if you don't have an in principle objection to vaccines and you think that other vaccines are safe, you should not have an objection to this because it didn't shirk the responsibility to go through the process. It was just for all of those reasons I just told you, it was an accelerated process that yielded the same results, hopefully safe vaccines.
So mRNA vaccines are a different type of vaccine, and there have been claims online that those vaccines alter our DNA, and so people are hesitant to use them. So how are these vaccines working differently than traditional vaccines? Is there a difference?
Yeah, traditionally a vaccine, whether, like I said, whether it's a viral vector or live attenuated, they're putting some aspect of the virus, the material of the virus in you so that your body learns how to respond to an attack from that virus in a much more muted attack form, right? Your immune system learns how to fight it on what would consider like a viral skirmish rather than a large viral battle. We put a little virus in there in some form or another, and your body attacks it, builds up an immune response, and then the next time you get it, it has that immune response prepared. In this particular, with mRNA, messenger RNA, that what we've done is we put this into you, and it goes into the cell without going into the nucleus. It teaches the cell how to make these little contact point and put it on the cell. It says, hey, when you're rebuilding the cell and doing all your work, put this little thing on there. This is the same type of contact point that we see on SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2. And so we understood the makeup of that. So we taught our body cells to put that on there. And then your immune system comes and sees that little thing on there and it says, that's not supposed to be there. Let's get that off of there. And so as it's doing that with all the cells that have told that this mRNA has told to put this little thing on your cell, it's building an immune response, not by having the virus in there, but by teaching your body to train it. Basically, your body is training it for a future event, right? Now, this is much more like training than it is like a skirmish. I was using the battle in the battle scenario, we give you a small army to fight before the big army hits. With mRNA, basically, it puts your body into a training program. It says, make a small number of these, put that on each one of those cells, just put one on there. And as the immune system goes and finds that on the cell and pulls it off, it's learning how to fight it. So when it shows up in its body in the form of COVID-19, it already has the ability to attack that contact point the same way it was doing on the cells that represent no risk to you. It's not altering your DNA because it doesn't get into your DNA at all. It has to get into the nucleus of the cell and to enter into the DNA. Once the message has been delivered by the mRNA vaccine, the body actually just deletes the mRNA information. It opens it, reads it, and then deletes it. You know, similar to like an old spy movie where the message is destroyed after being delivered. That's what happens with the mRNA vaccine. It delivers its message, telling the cell how to make that little contact point, and then it deletes it. And so it's not invading your DNA and changing your cellular structure in some way meant to help you to fight it because you've become a new super COVID fighting being. It's developed a training program by telling your cells how to produce this one contact point. And as it goes to cell and tells that it pursues that contact point, your body learns to deal with that contact point. And then when it sees that same contact point in COVID-19, it already knows what to do.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Jay Watts, who has written an online exclusive viewpoint article for the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called, Is It Ethical for Pro-Life Christians to Receive COVID-19 Vaccines? You can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Other ways you can partner with us would be just to tell a friend about this podcast and get the word out about our content. Another great way is to give us a few minutes of your time and rate or review our podcast. We would love to have you rate and review the podcast either with a starred review or, even better yet, a short sentence or two telling people why they should listen to the podcast. The other thing you can do is just give us a tip for all of the free content that we're bringing to you through these online articles as well as this podcast. And you can do that by going to our website, equip.org. Going to magazine at the drop-down menu, you'll see Postmodern Realities podcast right there in the middle. And then just on any landing page, we have a link where you could give us a small tip for our content. So you can also subscribe to the Christian Research Journal for $33.50 at our website, equip.org. Thank you for your partnership.
Well, those are kind of some of the practical questions that Christians have, but really the biggest scope of this article is the big question that most Christians have, and that is, what are the ethical ramifications of taking this vaccine? Because did the vaccine makers, you know, basically Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and Pfizer, those are the ones that are available to us, did the vaccine makers use aborted fetal cells to produce these vaccines? That's the biggest question on everyone's mind who's a pro-life Christian.
Yeah, and that's the one I hear, obviously, as someone who spends their life equipping people to have discussions about the value of human life, particularly most of everything I talk about has centers in some way around abortion, and then facing the idea of dealing with these vaccines and what we're going to do. It was a serious question in our household. My wife was a pro-life Christian long before I was. She was, long before I ever was committed to the pro-life position. And so for her, immediately she came to me and she said, I need to know what's going on before we move forward. And so as we looked in the research, the question is, and as it's put to me, are there aborted fetal cells in the vaccine? And the answer to that is no. Now, if you're asking, are there literally the cells of an aborted fetus used in either testing or the development of these vaccines, the answer is no. What is in there are what we call immortalized cell lines. Now, these immortalized cell lines, the two in particular that we're talking about here, one being the HEK293, which is the one that we talk about more than anything. This particular one, we believe, was developed from an abortion in the Netherlands in 1972. We can't verify that's for sure, but most information seems to indicate that that cell line was originally harvested from the remains of a human being that had been aborted and developed this immortalized cell line from the kidney cells of that particular unborn child that was the victim of abortion. And PERC6, which is another cell line that happened in, I believe, 1985. And we know that there was an abortion there, and that particular immortalized cell line has also been used in the production and the testing of these vaccines. But to understand what an immortalized cell line is and why I said no, there is not the cells of an aborted fetus in these cell lines, is because what they did was they took these cells and then they created an immortalized cell. They modified these cells so that they would reproduce and grow in a laboratory indefinitely in laboratory settings so that they could then modify them further for very specific uses and use them going forward. And never, so this cell line that exists now is not literally the cells that were taken from those aborted human beings. they are what we call a new artifact that derived from there, but is not identical to those things and have been changed over thousands of generations to be used in very particular areas of research, not just in medicine, but also in food production and in makeup. And so these are the answer to the question of when I was asked to me sometimes is, I am injecting in some way or another into my body aborted fetal cells. That answer is no. The cell lines that are used are no longer identical to the cells that were originally taken from that aborted fetus. And so there has been a change, a substantial change of what they were into a new thing. Now, if you're asking, are there cell lines being used that were originally derived from the evil of abortion? Then yes. Absolutely. The cell lines were derived. And are they human cell lines? Yes, they're human cell lines. The use of the modification of them didn't turn them into the cell lines of different animals. They just became human cells that were going to be used in a different way. But they're not literally the cells of those fetuses that were aborted. Those cells are long since gone and have been modified. And we've seen generation after generation of modification in the different applications. And so when we're asking that question, it's a yes, no thing. It's yes, that there was an abortion, there were in those cases, those two lines were abortions that are, and the evil of abortion is there. It's right there back in the background of the origination of all of this. When those cell lines were made, they were made from cells that were derived from the evil of abortion. That is true. But the cell lines themselves are no longer those cells. They have been modified, and it is not accurate to say that they're identical to the fetal cells that were used to generate the lines. They are now research immortalized cell lines that were originally derived from abortions. Now, that may be a distinction we're going to have to get through in a second as to what that means and how we morally evaluate these things. But it definitely answers the question of, are they made with aborted fetal cells? They are made with a cell line that was originally derived from aborted fetal cells, but no longer literally aborted fetal cells, if that makes sense.
Right. So I hear what you're saying to me is that the cells that have been used, you know, either for the testing or part of the production of the vaccine, depending on which vaccine it is, are not the literal cells of an aborted fetus because it was so long ago and it's been changed. But I guess, you know, I want to know is, aren't they still human fetal cells? And if they are, or they once were, doesn't that raise moral concerns for the pro-life Christian? I mean, even if it's generations and these, you know, some of these lines I hear are from the 1980s. So it's quite a while ago, more than 30 years ago, but still at its core, aren't these cells human? And is there a big moral concern for Christians because they are?
Well, there's no moral concern with testing on human cells in principle, right? It would be where they were derived from. And so I know like Joe Carter at the Gospel Coalition and his article about this says he doesn't like the idea of considering them even fetal cells because he would say fetus is the development stage that life was going through. These cells were harvested from an aborted fetus, but they're no longer fetal cells, meaning the fetus was the whole from which those cells were derived. And so he doesn't like the idea of calling fetal cells at all because he says they're no longer a part of a whole organism. They're an immortalized cell line that exists separate from that organism and that is no longer identical to the cells that were taken from that organism. They are human cells, and they are human cells that were originally derived from aborted fetus. So in that sense, it is weird to call them fetal cells because that would put them still as a part of the whole. But they are cells that have particular properties that are similar to or that come from fetal cells. And they are human because if they weren't human, they wouldn't be used in that arena. But the question of whether or not it makes sense, whether we start to have trouble with that, this objective claims vaccine cooperates with the immorality of abortions. Now we have to ask ourselves, what if we... How do we evaluate this? Because that's the claim. There is in the background, without argument, in some of these cell lines, and with one in all probability, the one that is most often used, the HEK, the human embryonic kidney cell, number 293, there's most likely an abortion there. And in the others, in PERC6, there definitely is. So does the evil of abortion back there at the source of these cell lines make it so we're cooperating morally in some way or cooperating with that evil in such that taking those cell lines or taking those vaccines that have been used for those cell lines is immoral by its very nature. And that is a much harder thing to parse through, right? The cooperation with evil it has a long history of how we work our way through that. And it's not just so simple as to say, because there was an abortion back in 1972 and 1985 associated with these two particular cell lines, therefore we are cooperating with evil when we take or partake in these vaccines. Because there are other factors that have to be considered other than that there was at one time somewhere in the development process the moral evil of abortion. So I understand why we have this attitude of being repulsed by it, this revulsion to it. But there's more to factoring through cooperation than just saying that evil exists. Now we have to figure out how every one of the people, the agents that are involved in making decisions throughout this, the researchers and the end users, how are we cooperating with evil? And that is a bigger question than just identifying that there's evil in the chain somewhere.
So, you know, how are Christians supposed to evaluate this idea that you're talking about, like cooperation with evil? I mean, do the people who object to using any of these vaccines because it's cooperating, you know, with the immorality of abortions? I mean, is that a valid point of view, that even because the original source was human, even though you're saying it's not part of the whole anymore, it's, you know, should we even call them fetal cells? But it's like, aren't we cooperating in some way with abortion because it was derived from abortion? I mean, how do we really evaluate that?
So there's aspects of cooperation that we have to go through, right? The first thing is, was it formal cooperation, meaning that we shared intent with the original act of evil? So if we look at the abortionist as performing an act of, you know, a moral act of evil, and assuming that the woman who sought this was performing a moral act of evil, did we share their intent? Did we want that abortion to happen so that we could harvest these cells? There is no intent by anybody back there who was harvesting these. As near as we can tell from the people who did that harvesting, these abortions were performed and they used those materials, but they did not actively seek those abortions to happen, and it wasn't the reason those abortions happened. So even there, it's question of whether it's material or formal. But let's go all the way down line. Are we in any way cooperating with intent for those abortions to happen? Well, no. So we would never qualify for what we would call formal cooperation with evil in the first place. And formal cooperation with evil is always wrong. If you share the intent of the evildoer, then the cooperator is sharing in the moral condemnation for what's happened. So we would fall into the category of what's called material cooperation, which means that we don't share the intent, or would possibly. The only thing we could fall into is material cooperation, which means we don't share the intent, but we do something that makes or helps the evil happen. And so at best, it's material cooperation. Another thing that I mentioned in the article was the idea of proximate. Were we close to it when it happened, or are we removed from it? So the farther away we get from that initial incident, the more we're removed from it. The person who initially bought those cells so that they could make the immortalized cell line has a closer proximity to the event than we do from 1972 all the way now back here to 2021. We are far removed from it. It's remote now. We have a remote relationship to this event that happened. So at best, we're talking about remote material cooperation. Immediate, meaning we weren't immediately involved in it. It's immediate, it's back after this all happened. So immediate remote material cooperation. And that's not necessarily evil in and of itself, because now we have to ask different questions about what happened. But the idea that we're somehow cooperating with it, with something that happened in that way, in a way that makes it so we're morally blameworthy, when we are this remote, when it's material cooperation, which material cooperation or evil concerns can be overridden by immediate concerns that are of such dire need and protecting this particular place, protecting the community from COVID-19, the need to serve that good can override our concerns about what even this remote material cooperation that we have with the evil. I would say that we don't have any cooperation with the evil, by the way. I think, though, but if you even accept that, let's say that you accept it, you accept some remote cooperation with evil, there are other concerns that would override that and would still make it morally licit, morally okay to take the vaccine.
That answers that question. I think there's still some Christians that are quite opposed to it.
Yeah.
In any case, which is why, if people are wondering, we are calling this an op-ed. We're calling it a viewpoint because what Jay is talking about today, not all Christians agree with.
No,
so,
no.
So if we broaden our moral responsibility in order to see that, you know, using these vaccines as illicit, do they have any unintended consequences? And then how do we apply that? I mean,
yes.
You know, I guess that's a big question, because sometimes we have these convictions, and they're deep convictions about big issues like, you know, the morality of abortion. But how do we also apply the way that we see those kinds of things to other areas of our lives? In other words, if we see that we would be morally guilty in this particular scenario, like, how do we live our lives with daily choices? Because I would say, well, do I know for a fact that drugs that are prescribed to get me better for whatever ailment that I have, do most of us follow, as much as everybody has become, you know, now immunization experts and so forth, just by reading news articles? I mean, I don't know that I know everything about clinical trials of anything that's prescribed to me. Do I know that any kind of fetal lines were used? So how do we navigate this, you know, practically and also ethically?
You almost can't. And that's the crazy thing about it. Philosophy professor at University of America, Melissa Michelis, she says, one of the things that I don't understand about this is why we're having this reaction to this use, particularly, let's say, HEK293, of this cell line on this issue, when this cell line has been used in so many places over decades, we couldn't possibly track its use. I mean, I had one doctor tell me that you have not had any probably major medical treatment in your life, if you've had anything that hasn't been touched by this particular cell line. One guy on his website, and I linked to it in the article, gave a list of over-the-counter drugs that have used these cell lines. As I mentioned earlier, cosmetic lines moved to using these cell lines to get away from animal testing. When we're talking about, I knew a guy many years ago that worked in a food flavoring company that sold his flavorings to all of these major food producers that produce food and send it out all over the world. And they used these lines in testing their flavors. And so when you're just talking about, even if you just wanted to avoid HEK293, like, we embrace this idea that I am morally culpable for my remote material cooperation with the abortion that happened that started this particular immortalized cell line, then I will be paralyzed for the rest of my life in evaluating every aspect of everything that I buy and use to try to find some way to avoid it. And that's just one. That's just talking about one cell line, right? And there are so many decisions that we make on a daily basis that have a much closer cooperation with evil than using the research byproducts produced by this particular cell line. For example, where I buy my coffee. I am stunned by how many Christians who just love Starbucks and talk about it all the time, at the same time, are getting angry about this cell line. It's like, okay, well, look, you are giving money to organizations all the time that are out there fighting. I know so many Christians that use Netflix without blinking. They don't even flinch about it at all. And Netflix has said at one time in Georgia that they would fight legally Georgia laws attempted to restrict abortion. And go through your neighborhood and try to find out every person that you're spending money with and you're helping benefit or profiting that organization, either how that organization is using that money that you're giving them, perhaps giving gifts to Planned Parenthood, or how the person that's profiting by owning that organization is spending their money. And you're going to find out, you're going to spend the rest of your life trying to track down where everything is going so that you can assess some level of guilt to your interaction. Now, I don't say this dismissively. At the end of the day, what you figure out is that we live in an incredibly broken world. And if we understand material cooperation to this extent, then everything that we do, almost every interaction at every level, is somehow tainted with these past evils that we just can't escape. However immediate or immediate they are, however proximate or remote they are, our material cooperation in them and our attempt to avoid it will just take over our life. We won't be able to live in any real sense at all, because there are things that I could list for the next 20 minutes that are more proximate as far as material cooperation and evil than we're talking about with this cell line and the evil that occurred back in 1972. That's not to dismiss the importance of that evil, nor is it to dismiss the importance of the realization that we're surrounded by a broken world that's forcing us to cooperate in a market where we can't even keep track of all of the things that we're cooperating in. But it's just to recognize that if we open up, the unintended consequences of that will be paralyzing us or force us to live in some strange way off the grid, out there in the middle of nowhere. You can't use your cell phones, by the way, because there's moral issues with those and how those batteries and the different things that are made. You're not going to be able to use anything. You're going to have to become basically some person that lives off and plants your own crops and lives off of that and has nothing to do with anything in the modern world. That's, again, I don't say that in a way that I don't consider that a bad thing. It's recognizing we live in a fallen world and we're surrounded by evil. Engaging our material cooperation in it is something that we must try to do, but that we can't do to the extent that we're doing like this. That level of material cooperation would just leave us paralyzed to operate at all in this world.
I think that's so true on many different levels. I mean, even when you're talking about, they use these lines for flavors. I mean, I've read books about, you know, people who develop flavoring for foods, and it's like, you know, it's in the candy that your kids eat, you know, the watermelon flavor or whatever flavor that we like, and ice cream, some of that says artificial flavors, or even if it says natural flavors, they can say that because they use natural things to come up with these fake flavors. But it's still, like you said, it's being used. And I know none of us do that kind of in-depth research, whether it's medication or if somebody's sick or has cancer, do they know exactly how everything was tested that they're taking? So those are kinds of things that people have to really look at the scope of what it really means if you're going to hold very firmly to that with regard to this one particular vaccine.
Yeah, especially, and I understand why it's the revulsion that goes along with it, but that's why in this discussion, hopefully as you talk about my opinion or where I'm coming from, and it's my own looking into it, is, yeah, we've got to balance our revulsion with a reasonable understanding about what we're actually talking about.
So you're talking about cooperating with evil, that some people see actually this vaccine as if we take it because of the cell lines that were used that were directly cooperating with evil, which you made an argument that how we're not doing that. But is there a sense of appropriating evil? In other words, you know, we're taking these vaccines and we're enjoying the benefit of this vaccine. In other words, helping to stop the pandemic and helping to protect other people from, you know, that are vulnerable from getting it. But we're enjoying these benefits that are a result of an act of moral evil, you
yes,
know?
Yes.
So, so what's the difference in those two, you know, nuances between cooperating with evil and appropriating evil?
Yeah, in cooperation, something that we're doing is obviously contributing to the evil. Even with material cooperation, even if we don't intend it, it is. For multiple reasons, I don't see cooperation. I do think appropriation is a serious consideration here, because appropriation means, as you've pointed out, we are benefiting from a past action of evil. So there's a past act of evil, and I am I'm appropriating that evil to my benefit. There are risks that go with the appropriation of evil, just as a category of thinking these things through. One of those risks is that I desensitize myself to the initial evil that I am now using. And by doing that, I've become self-deceived. And if I do that, if I lose sight of the idea that there is anything back there in that background at all that I need to worry about, I open myself up to the idea that I should just go about my life and not worry about these things at all. I didn't say that. Obviously, as I said, we have to recognize we live in a broken, fallen world and we are surrounded by evil. We must do the best we can to mitigate against that and how it affects and impacts our lives. And we can't ever back down from saying that abortion is evil for those of us who are pro-life. We can't ever say that it's okay, it's good, or that we're not worried about that being back there. We can still see that and say it's evil and it's back there. The danger of appropriation is that I stop saying that. And I stop worrying about it. And then the next danger is that my passivity or by the omission of my objection to these things, like if I don't tell them, look, because you have given us no choice and for the good of the community, to seek the good of the community, the health of the community, I have been given sufficient justification to override either my concerns of material cooperation or appropriation to seek to cooperate with receiving those vaccines. But I don't like it. And we are going to push you to stop using cell lines that were originated in something as evil as abortion so that we can all celebrate the advancement of science. Because as we said, the use of human cell lines in and of itself is not bad. It's that we're in some way appropriating an evil for our benefit. And the danger there is not that I'm actually doing evil, but that I'm going to stop seeing evil, stop speaking out against evil. And in my silence or the omission of my protest about the evil that is going on, I'm going to empower the people who are doing evil to feel free to do even more, to seek more evil. Now, I don't see that. I've read from a lot of different experts on this, And as far as empowering others to make evil decisions by protesting the use of HEK 293, I don't see that happening because what happens with HEK 293 is we have this thing that's existent, that's working. And so I'm not encouraging anyone to do more abortions, to produce more lines, because they don't want more lines. They have lines that are working and they've been testing for decades and that they know are reliable and that they can predict how they're going to respond to different things. And that's a value in a research setting. And so you're not cooperating with evil or encouraging evil, either through cooperation or appropriation, because the HEK 293 cell line exists. And so I don't see that particular risk in this place as I talk to people, but I do hear, and I'm very, very sensitive to the people who say there is some appropriation here, but that appropriation can be overridden by other concerns, we can get to a justification for overlooking that appropriation when the community has a greater need that must be met. But we cannot shirk our responsibility to speak to the evil, both of abortion and to the need to move on from these cell lines to other cell lines. And that what is the appropriate response to appropriation. What you have to do is guard yourself against the pitfalls of appropriating that evil by saying, look, we're going to recognize that there's some appropriation of evil, but that we're morally justified in doing so. But in order to guard ourselves from either self-deception or from becoming agents of omission and empowering people to continue to do more evil, we're going to continue to speak out against what we see that is wrong. And that is different than cooperation, where I am actually leading to or help in some way contributing to the act of evil. When we're talking about appropriation, we're talking about benefiting from a past act of evil and the risks that incur, not just for me as an individual, which is of the utmost importance that I'm living as a virtuous human being as I ought to and closely into the line and acting as God would have me act, but also as what it will ultimately do to those people that are determined to do evil around us and see my silence as consent. So there goes back to that avulsion we talked about, right? We have to express that revulsion. We have to express our misgivings. We have to express and define the evil of abortion so that we don't fall into the traps of appropriation.
But if we are acknowledging that abortion is a killing of human beings and we're not, you know, kind of being blasé about it or not thinking about it anymore or not standing up for the truth of what abortion actually is, the fact that these lines were used, wouldn't that mere fact that we're benefiting from this past evil, even if it was in the 70s and 80s from an aborted fetus, even though those cells have really changed and not the original cells from those fetuses, I mean, does that leave us morally guilty for receiving these vaccines? Because I think for some, it's going to shut the door on the vaccines made because originally way back when it was a fetus. So should all Christians have that view that it's going to shut the door on us receiving these vaccines?
No, I do think that we have to have room for people to follow their conscience. And there is, when we're talking about appropriation or even when we're talking about material cooperation and evil, I do believe that it is commonly understood that there can be justifications to override those concerns because there is sufficient moral justification or need or necessity for action that we're required to take that action, or at least it gives us justification in taking that action so we're not morally guilty in doing so. And in that particularly seeking the good of our community, as I said, I have a type 1 diabetic daughter. I have a stroke surviving wife who struggles with hypertension. And so these are people who are greater at risk. And so I have to think about how to protect my family. You can be an objector. I'm not saying that all Christians should do or make the decisions that I'm making. I actually believe if you look at all of this and you come to a personal position that you are going to speak with a prophetic voice to our culture by rejecting the vaccine use altogether and are willing to deal with everything that comes with that as you're going to make an example of that particular rejection, then hey, I'm for you, man. I think you should have that right to reject it. I do agree, though, with all of the other people that say, as you make that moral decision, if your reason for rejecting it is because of what you consider to be the moral contamination of the entire process because of these original acts of abortion back in this particular case, as we're talking about 1972 and 1985, then you do have some responsibility to act as somebody who recognizes that COVID-19 is a danger to their community, certain members of their community, and to take the necessary steps to protect people from the fact that you were not immunized and that you were going to be at greater risk for severe symptoms from it and perhaps greater risk for transmission from it. And so if you're going to take this as a prophetic voice, you have to deal with what comes with that. And at the same time, you have to act in such a way as to protect the members of your community from the natural evil of COVID-19 as best you can. Because if you just don't think COVID-19 is a big deal, this is not really an argument for you. This isn't a discussion for you. But if you agree that COVID-19 is dangerous and is a big deal and represents a specific danger to the elderly, to people who are dealing with underlying medical conditions, to particular minority communities that are being impacted by it disproportionately than others, if you see and say, I know it's a danger to those people, but I refuse to cooperate at all with any or to appropriate at all the evil of abortion that was the origination of these cell lines, then now you have a moral responsibility and duty to do everything that you can short of taking the vaccine to protect the community from exposure through you to this virus. Now, again, if you just don't think the virus is a big deal, this isn't for you. But this whole discussion is all about people who believe that the virus is dangerous, isn't a big deal, but are going to reject the use of the vaccine because they believe it is either morally cooperating with the evil or any appropriation of it is so evil that they can't do that. So I leave that up to them, right? Make that decision. But if you make that decision, you have to be willing to act in some protective manner for the rest of the people in the culture. I think it's not enough to shut the door of the vaccine because I think that you have to make this decision personally and you have to evaluate it. I came to the decision that I think that using the vaccines are morally okay. I think that if you make the decision not to, I don't think it's helpful then for you to go around condemning everybody who does. I think that you don't want to condemn, for example, you know, by some of my friends, 86-year-old elderly people who were terrified because their doctors assured them if they got this, they would die. And they took the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine. And then to be turned around and to have somebody who rejects it on those grounds look at them and say, you are morally responsible for the abortion that happened in some way or another back in participation and in your moral cooperation with abortion. Because these 86-year-olds have spent their life giving money to pro-life organizations. And now to have some pro-life person turn around to them and tell them that they are responsible for abortions, I think is monstrously unfair. And that they don't have anywhere near the moral reasoning to be able to make that charge against somebody else. So if your conscience tells you not to take it, then don't take it. But I don't think you have enough moral support for you to say, I'm not going to take it. And everybody who does take it is morally condemnable.
And I think you're right about what you're saying about protecting your community, because there are a lot of people out there that don't ever get sick, but they actually have active virus. And you don't know if you're that person. So you'd have to just constantly be aware, maybe get tested and figure out, you know, maybe you have to wear a mask longer than other people who are vaccinated, because you know, you don't want to be able to. And I know that people have said that, well, I don't think I'm responsible for the death of your grandmother if I don't wear a mask or whatever. But it is known that there's community spread. So you have to really consider what that would look like if you decide not to take the vaccine. And so some of these issues that hopefully will be a lot of food for thought for folks. So I know in your article, you talk about specific Christian philosophers and Christian bioethicists in the pro-life movement, you know, people like Robert P. George, Ryan Anderson, Maureen Condict that you mentioned, and they seem to have objected to this idea that there's any cooperation or even appropriation at all. So why do those philosophers and bioethicists, in the case of Maureen Condict, why do they think that talking in these terms is not helpful on this issue? It's a mistake. We shouldn't address particularly this vaccine in these kinds of terms, either of cooperation or appropriation.
Because what they see is what they would see as a category error. They see us talking about things like cell lines, which they would define as an artifact, and talking about these things in terms of morality. Is it immoral or not immoral, licit or illicit? And what they would say is, like, this is an artifact. This is a thing. And this cell line, if it's not identical to the and generations and generations removed from the cells that were harvested to originate this. They're saying, so now what we're looking at is a thing that's been in existence since 1970. So they said the idea of, first of all, they would say the idea of cooperation with evil in either one of these cases is not possible, right? How do I in any way act in such a way as to have made an abortion that happened in 1972 happen? There's nothing I can do today to make that happen, right? That happened in 1972. The things that I'm doing today are not cooperating to that act of evil. So if what is tainting this process is that original act of abortion, which all of these people, passionate, outspoken pro-lifers and leaders in the community, every single one of them will look at that act of abortion and say it is evil. But what they're going to say is it was evil. And it was an evil act that was done in 1972. The whole discussion of cooperation with it doesn't even make sense. There is no way that I can do anything today that is going to in any way make that happen. I didn't participate in it happening. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm not participating in them aborting more children for the sake of these cell lines, because these cell lines exist and they're not making new cell lines. They're using the ones that they have. And so they would say, you would have to be able to have some event to where the thing that I was doing was causing it to happen in some way or another, or facilitating it happening, for there to be any cooperation. And so there can't be cooperation in something that happened 50 years ago. And there can't be something that happened 40 years ago. That's just not the way cooperation works. But they say even appropriation at this point, because we're not appropriating the evil of that abortion. That abortion happened 50 years ago, 30 some odd years ago. What they're saying is what we're doing now is making use of an existing artifact that has properties that make it useful for medical research, for consumer research, for makeup, for all of these different applications. And the use of that is not the appropriation of that original evil. It's the recognition that evil happened so long in the past that everyone that's using that is removed now from it, to the point that it doesn't make sense to talk about moral guilt for anybody involved in this. We're not participating to further evil, not creating evil, not desensitizing ourselves to the act of abortion that happened in 1972 or 1985. We're not creating instances of more abortion by participating in this. All we're doing is recognizing that this fetal cell line that exists, these immortalized cell lines that were derived from an aborted fetus are now a thing in and of themselves, removed from that fetus, and have existed for decades, and it no longer makes sense to attach moral guilt to their use. They oftentimes use, and one of the most popular uses is the example of our railroads, right? There is no doubt that Chinese immigrants and black slaves in the United States were used horribly and immorally and evilly in the creation of certain sections of the railroads in the United States. They were, you know, to the point of even being murdered. And so this is deeply evil. But those aren't the rail lines that exist today, although they're overlaid over those particular rail lines. The rail lines that exist today are new lines that have been laid over those. And the commerce of the United States, the movement of products across the United States, would be impossible without these rail lines. To say nothing of the movement of people, we're talking about just the movement of products right now. The way that our commerce and our world is built is dependent upon the movement of things along those rail lines. And nobody looks at those rail lines anymore and thinks use and cooperation or appropriation of those. And we have to think of it in those terms. And every time we see a railroad car, we're going to have to wrestle with the morality of how those railways originally came into existence, even though nobody is going to look at those things and say, oh, those people were not treated horribly, or that wasn't evil. Every reasonable person, every moral person is going to say those Chinese immigrants, those black slaves were treated evilly, and that should have never happened. And that it's a great and terrible evil and a terrible fact of history, but they're not going to still see continued guilt or need to wrestle with that appropriation today. In the same way, Dr. Michelle, who I mentioned earlier, Melissa Michelle, talks about if you have a mother who murders her child, and then it's realized after that child has been murdered that she has organs that are useful for transplant, and if we use those organs to save someone else, the person who is saved from the use of those transplants did not cooperate. And most people, I don't reasonably would assume that that person cooperated in the murder by the mother who killed her child. They will just see them as having had the benefit of that act of, or through the act of appropriation, right? And so what they're saying is there's no appropriation, there's no cooperation. We're just so far removed from it at that point. There's just the use of an immortalized cell line that has no moral nature to it whatsoever. Agents are moral. You and I are moral. We can do evil. We can work evil. We can make decisions that are evil. We can be wrong. We can be condemned for the things that we do. But artifacts aren't like that. This is just a thing that exists that's being used, and it's so far removed from its original source that they're saying there's no reason any longer to keep that moral tainting that goes along with it. Now, not everybody agrees with them, but that's just their argument. So they say, look, there's no reason to wrestle with appropriation. There's no reason to wrestle with the cooperation. That's just a misunderstanding and a category of mistake. These things exist in and of themselves, and they're so far removed from their origin that there's no reason to sit here and wrestle with whether or not we are somehow cooperating with evil. It's understandable because of the deeply held feelings and beliefs of pro-lifers, but these people say it's just not a thing. It's not an issue.
Well, I guess what you're saying, my question to you, though, is do these Christian philosophers, I mean, they're very well known, or these Christian bioethicists, do they understand how, like, the average, you know, pro-life Christian is struggling to get past feeling very uneasy and maybe even horrified, feeling very badly that this vaccine, there might be something unseemly, because even though it's not the actual cells of the, you know, the fetus, it's not part of the whole anymore, there's just, you know, I'm still benefiting from this thing done in the past. Now, again, because we have a pandemic, these kind of issues are coming up. Like you said, we didn't even know before this podcast. I don't know that I knew that flavoring in food was, you know, used these fetal cell lines. So, you know, how do they even address the Christians that feel very uncomfortable with this? And, you know, they do think that there's morality that they have to wrestle with about this.
There is, I did not cite this in the article, but in public discourse, there is a wonderful dialogue, I think, between Richard Stith and Dr. Michelle, who I've mentioned a couple of times, about this particular issue, because he had an emotional response to being told not to have an emotional response. And he contacted them in a great spirit and said to all of these writers who contributed to this, I would like to say, how can you tell people not to have these feelings? How can you tell people not to respond to them? It's the proper response. It's the proper feeling. And in this great dialogue, when she responds, her response to Dr. Sis, she says, that's the reason why we're offering this moral framework as a way of understanding this issue, is because we get the feelings. We understand the feelings. But feelings, moral feelings of revulsion, are not always trustworthy. And she uses the case of interracial marriage. She said there was a time when people had moral revulsion to interracial marriage. There was no grounding. As a matter of fact, that particular revulsion was wrong. And so she's saying, in this, I'm not saying that's what's going on in this particular case, but she wanted to use that as a demonstration of how our revulsions do not necessarily communicate truth. So their response, through her response, is to say, of course we understand that there's an emotional response to this, and nobody's telling you not to feel. What we're saying is the processing of this morally, as we're looking to assign guilt, because that's the biggest problem, right? We're looking to assign guilt. We're looking to say that if you use X vaccine, you are cooperating with abortion, and you have done something, and you are morally guilty of that cooperation. And so when we're looking to assign guilt, we have to be very cautious and work our way through. And we can't let our emotions be the primary guide on that trip. What we need to do is look for a map to navigate the way that we process these things morally and to understand our moral relationship to these artifacts. And she, I think, says, look, appropriation is the only way to look at it that makes sense. Cooperation can't be on the table. Appropriation would be the only way to make sense of this. And if you see appropriation here, then you have the duty and responsibility to guard yourself against desensitizing and giving and empowering people through the omission of your voice. Speak out. Fight these things. Say these things publicly. Go on record. I'm all for that. And Richard Stith's response was that he agrees with that as well, that we have a moral duty and responsibility to continue to voice our opposition to the use of these cell lines and the evil of abortion in our community. But what they want to make clear is you follow the dictates of your conscience, but you do not have the moral support to condemn those people who see that the unique situation that we face ourselves here with COVID-19 and the need to vaccinate people to protect the most people that we can protect is going to override some of those concerns that you have. And in their particular case, they're saying is a category mistake altogether, because you're assigning moral guilt or blame or illicitness to artifacts that don't make decisions. It's just a thing that exists and is no longer in any way should be seen as connected to the origin or its source. And so, yes, they're sensitive to that. And her response to Stith, I think, is beautiful, because she says, it's because we're sensitive to this that we're trying to clearly show the pathway that we made in our moral reasoning to reach the decision that you are morally free to participate in this vaccination by receiving these vaccines and not worry about it take them and don't feel like you have to defend yourself and don't feel like other people who judge you for it have the moral grounds to make you, as I said, going back to those 86-year-old people that I love, the idea of pro-lifers turning on them now and telling these people who are pro-life people who have spent and given resources of their life to being able to contribute to the cause of the pro-life movement, to have them turn on them now and say, you are guilty of moral cooperation and abortion, is outrageous. And that's why they're saying we can't do that. They're not saying you have to take the vaccine. Nobody's saying that you have to take the vaccine. Nobody's saying that you can't follow the dictates of your own conscience. They're just saying that you can't take those dictates of your conscience that move you to the position of rejecting the vaccine and then turn around and condemn others who take it.
So, you know, just to wrap this up, like, where do we end up after this discussion, particularly about the nuances of some of the ethical things that we have to think through when we think about abortion and, you know, the development of medicine? And so, you know, are there any clear biblical duties that compels Christians to action in spite of, you know, some of the things that we've talked about? Is there any clarity for the pro-life Christian, or how should we even move forward, I guess, is what I'm wondering what you think about that.
I think, and I remember you and I having a discussion right when COVID-19 stay-at-home orders came into existence. And we were, I remember in our discussion talking about the idea of a new understanding of what it means to love our neighbor. And that became such a phrase that came up so often, I see many of my Christian friends recoil from it, which is odd because what they don't like is the idea that the call to love our neighbor in their mind has been manipulated to the point that we are abdicating ourselves of responsibilities to recognize that some of the things that we have done, isolating our neighbor is harming our neighbor, financially hurting our neighbor is harming our neighbor. We're missing other harms while we're embracing one particular definition of loving our neighbor. So I do think, though, that as horrible this is, and I say this as somebody who has lost people through this process of living through COVID-19 and who has seen people that I love lose their closest family members, as horrible it all is, I think that the fact that it opened a conversation and meaningfully about what it means to love our neighbor is important, particularly, I think, also when it comes to how we deal with illness and sickness. I think that there are goods that should be taken from this, that I don't want to live the rest of my life hiding from my neighbor and afraid that if he breathes on me, I'm going to die. But at the same time, I hope people take more seriously the idea that if you're sick, stay at home. And not just if you're sick from COVID. If you've got a nasty cold, stay at home. If you've got the flu, stay at home. If nothing, we should have learned from this that we can slow down infection if we just stay home when we're sick. And I'm not talking about stay at home forever, and I'm not talking about hide out from your friends, but I used to notice more before this all started, people who saw virtue and carrying on as if nothing had changed when they were sick. And for years, I used to have arguments with people and say, stay at home when you're sick. You're getting the rest of us. And I feel like we'll always say we're broadening our understanding of what it means to love our neighbor when we're talking about illness. And so in this, I think we are stuck with one thing. If we recognize that COVID is a threat to members of our community, and that there are certain particular members of our community and particular groups within our community who are at greater risk than others of us, then we do have a duty and responsibility as Christians to love our neighbors ourselves and to find the best way that we can to recognize our need to operate in a protective mode for those people and to not just say, hey, if you die because I came into contact with you, I'm not morally guilty, which, by the way, I agree with. Viruses spread. That's what they do. I talked to a man recently, a friend of mine, who, when he visited his son, he accidentally brought COVID into the life of his family. It wasn't just his family he was worried about, though. There was this woman who worked at a school where his grandkids went. And he said, if that woman had gotten COVID, I would be crushed. And he was going through this moral guilt. And I had to tell him, you didn't do anything wrong. You just lived your life. You took every available safeguard possible to keep you and your family safe. And you just got the virus anyway. And you passed it on to people unintentionally without knowing that was what you were doing. And that's just what viruses do. And so it doesn't make any sense to go around blaming people that others are getting sick. But it does make sense for us to look at this and say, at the end of the day, you should have freedom to reject the vaccine. I believe that. At the end of the day, you should have the moral freedom to receive the vaccine. I believe that. But everybody should operate at a heightened awareness about how our actions are affecting the people around us. And isn't that really what we've been talking about this entire time? Understanding better the world that we live in, having some sense of the fallenness or brokenness of it that contributes to some of the things we accept daily. I mean, if we could, you and I could sit here and start listing off all of the things that are a part of the human experience in our daily lives that in some way or another that we know we could trace back to not just morally questionable things, but to morally condemnable actions. And if we play that game and we start to play that game, there is some good maybe that comes of it because we become more aware of our surroundings. But we also, I think, hopefully come to a place where we have a more sober recognition of the world that we live in. And then we recognize that the problem that we face is that it is really difficult not to be involved in things that we don't want to be involved in this world that we live in. But that's the very reason for the hope that is within us to something greater coming. That's the reason we're to hope for the return of Jesus, to want. I was just recently reading the Psalms and the prophets with some young people, and we're reading Abraham Heschel's book, The Prophets. And one of the things we discussed was the prophets want the judgment of God because they want justice. They want right restored. They're looking for God to make things right. The psalmists are looking for God to deal with injustice. And you can't pray for God to make things right without a deep and profound understanding about how wrong things are. And so hopefully what we can take from this is a broader understanding of what it means to love our neighbors, particularly when we're talking about illness, and also to have as best we can a greater understanding about the evil that's always around us and that we are in some manner or another cooperating with, and to try to limit our cooperation as best we can, but at the same time recognize to some degree or another it's the cost of living in this world is that we are going to be touched by the evil of this world. And the best that we can do is to seek God and to live in the hope of Him coming in justice to restore us to the way it ought to have been all along. It gives me great hope at the same time as great sadness for the world that we live in.
And if anyone would like to hear Jay and my discussion on what it means to love your neighbor, in fact, our discussion was just about 1 year ago. It was April 2020, and it was episode 174. So if you haven't already heard that, if you're newer to the podcast or you might have missed it before, look up episode 174 with Jay Watts. It's not a very long episode, just 15 minutes or so. And we talk about what it means to love our neighbor and why we've been really considering that in the midst of a pandemic. Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have some fun rapid fire questions for Jay that I'd like to end with. Jay, I don't think I've ever asked you, what's your favorite meal?
Sushi. There's a lot of things I like. I'm a person that really likes to eat, but I would probably say and it's a particular sushi. I love all sushi, but there's a particular sushi meal I eat when I go out with my family at a restaurant here in the Metro Atlanta area. And I love it. And what makes me happiest is that the guy who owns the sushi restaurant loves my plate as well. Every time I'm there and he looks at it, he comes over to tell my family that I have ordered almost the perfect plate of sushi, and he just loves the plate that I've put together. And so that's my favorite meal. I love sushi. I can eat sushi every day.
And what is the last photo that you took on the camera roll of your smartphone?
I do not know. Let me see. I accidentally took a picture this morning while I was doing a workout with these young lacrosse players of the timer on my phone. So that's the last picture I took. I have a new phone that I get when I upgraded my tech. And so the way that it takes pictures with the volume buttons is new to me. And so I accidentally take a lot of pictures. So that was my last picture, was the timer on my phone that I was using when we were working out this morning. And prior to that, it was actually my daughter was all on the set all day yesterday of Cobra Kai. My daughter loves to do background work in the Atlanta area. And so I took a picture of Mr. Miyagi's house and some of his classical cars when I was leaving the set.
So knowing what you know now, and you just told us in this podcast, you just turned 50. What advice would you give to your 18-year-old self?
Floss, take care of your teeth better. some of the lessons 18-year-old Jay was a mess. So he wouldn't have listened to almost anything that I said to him, but I do think that, and he would have seen me I hated Christians back then, but if I could give him, and I don't mean that was ridiculous. I really do. As I've gotten older, I wish I'd taken better care of my teeth. And I don't have a huge problem with my teeth, but man, I remember the first time I started taking it seriously was when I started having dental issues in my 30s. And I thought, man, I wish I could go back and tell that guy that. I think every other thing, I don't like to play that game too much because I'm so very happy with where God has gotten me to in life. And so I live in fear of time travel and someone being able to go back and I make some mistake that throws off this great place where I am, because I'm just deliriously happy with my wife and my kids and the things that God lets me do in life. So it would be minor changes too, because every other lesson Jay needed to learn to get here, right? And the way that God taught me wouldn't work for everybody, but it worked very well for me. And I've ended up with a very lovely fate that keeps me centered where I ought to be most of the time. And I know the cost of that was every awful thing that I had to endure. So I'd probably stay away from all of those things, let Jay learn his lessons, but just hopefully he takes care of his teeth better.
And if you didn't have to sleep, what would you do with the extra time?
Read more. Oh my gosh. Read and write. I love reading and I love writing. I love both. And when I was younger, I didn't sleep much and I missed that. I missed being able to go on very few hours of sleep. Now that I've gotten older, I found that I have to sleep more. I have to be more serious about that. But it would just be reading and writing. Because that's what I used to do when I was younger. Everybody would go to sleep and I would read for hours after everybody went to bed.
Maybe your 75-year-old self will say, Jay, when you're 50, you should have slept more.
Should have slept more. Well, I'm trying.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Jay Watts, who has written an online exclusive viewpoint article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called, Is It Ethical for Pro-Life Christians to Receive COVID-19 Vaccines? And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comments section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.